We have got coming up over the next couple of weeks, 8 events. It probably is the most intense time we've had since I've been here. And I just want to direct your attention to a couple of things. On Tuesday of next week at 5:30, Mike Isikoff, the investigative reporter for the Washington Post, who first achieved fame and notoriety when he uncovered the Monica Lewinsky scandal, has now done a book called Hubris, the inside story of spin scandal and the selling of the Iraq war. He will be here Tuesday afternoon at 5:30. And then on Friday, also at 5:30 on Friday, will be Tom Ricks, also a reporter for the Washington Post, who has written what has been over the last several weeks the number one bestseller on the Times list called Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq. One of my waggish friends, looking at Isikoff and Ricks and the juxtaposition, said, well, hubris precedes the fiasco. And the following week on Monday, General Stephen Whitcomb, who is commanding the ground troops in the Middle East, will be here. On Tuesday, the 24th, Matthew Bogdanos, who is a prosecutor in New York City, who early in his career prosecuted Sean P. Diddy Combs, but now prosecutes art fraud cases. He was asked to go to Baghdad after the looting and try to recover the stolen artworks. And he did that with a relatively high degree of success. He's written a very interesting book called Thieves of Baghdad. Very interesting person will be here on Tuesday the 24th. On Wednesday the 25th, Jeffrey Goldberg, who has written the authoritative works on Hezbollah, will be here. And finally, the last Monday of the month, in celebration of United Nations Day, Ambassador William Lures, who directs the UN Association in the United States, will be here. So I would like to invite all of you to come back for what's proving to be a very intensive examination of what's going on in the world, but especially in the Middle East. There will be a book signing for General Zinni's book, The Battle for Peace. It will be in the area we call the Hyphen, the other end of the building, out towards the library. The University of Virginia bookstore has got a good supply of the books, and General Zinni will be glad to sign those books following his talk. In order to avoid sort of chaos as we leave the room, let me ask, after we thank General Zinni for his appearance here today, that we let him leave the room and go down to where the book signing will be so that he doesn't get jammed up in the crowd. And let me also mention that we have another event scheduled for this room, a colloquium at 12:30. So as much as we love to extend hospitality to everybody and ask you to stay and enjoy our facilities, on this occasion, let me invite you to exit the room promptly after General Zinni has left, so we don't have people sort of falling all over each other. I'm delighted to welcome you to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, the director of the forum. Our guest today is General Anthony C. Zinni, retired United States Marine Corps. General Zinni joined the Marine Corps in 1965 and was commissioned an infantry second lieutenant upon his graduation from Villanova with a degree in economics. He has also earned master's degrees in international relations and in management and supervision, and holds an honorary doctorate from William & Mary. He's taught at VMI, at Berkeley, at Villanova, in addition to William & Mary. He served in over 70 countries and has received virtually every award a soldier can earn. Immediately prior to his retirement in 2000, he was Commander-in-Chief of the United States Central Command. He followed General Norman Schwarzkopf and preceded General Tommy Franks as the CENTCOM commander in charge of all American troops in the Middle East. Since retirement, he has participated at the request of President Bush as a special envoy to the Middle East and in diplomatic missions in Somalia, Pakistan, and Ethiopia, among other places. He presently is president of international operations of MIC Industries, and he's the author of two New York Times bestsellers. The first he co-authored with Tom Clancy, called Battle Ready, and the book that is presently out called The Battle for Peace. Please join me in welcoming Tony Zinni.
Thank you very much. I think that's the first time I've been mentioned along with P. Diddy Combs, so I am honored to share this podium with people of that distinction. I want to talk a little bit about, obviously, the book, but more importantly, why the book. As was mentioned, I spent 40 years in government service, about 39 years in the military. I actually joined the Marine Corps in 1961. And the last 10 years of that time, plus the few years after that that I did some work for the U.S. State Department, Secretary Powell, in peace mediation, it struck me that the world had changed significantly. And that's what the book is about, the changes that I noted. And I think that we somehow missed the changes. I think if we go through what happened, and I will briefly, we'll understand that the world changed, but it wasn't the sort of after effect of some sort of cataclysmic event like we had in the First World War, Second World War. This one was a threat out there, the Cold War, the Soviet Union, communism, that just sort of fizzled and died. And maybe that sort of caught us off guard to understand in that last century that we just left, there were three major reorderings of the world. We certainly know at the end of the First World War that we had to relook at a different kind of world. And if you remember your history lessons, President Wilson really tried to get our nation and our Congress to focus on the need to become more engaged, more involved, because unless we helped change the conditions out there, colonialism, militarism, we were doomed to repeat the problems we went through in that First World War. Of course, we didn't listen to him. We were naturally more isolationist. We followed the dictates of Jefferson and Washington not to become involved and entangled in those messes beyond our mighty oceans. At the end of the Second World War, which I think is probably one of the most remarkable periods of our history and worth looking at significantly because of what it meant in the way we approached a new ordered world, President Truman, George Marshall, looked at a world, much as President Wilson did, one that, that required us to engage, required us to be involved, required us to try to help stabilize, or else we were going to repeat what we just went through. And remarkably, even though we Americans and even the Congress were reluctant to do so once again, they were able, through force of leadership, to make the changes happen. They not only, of course, did things that we all know about, like produce the European Recovery Plan, the Marshall Plan, to create the first real military alliance that we had ever been part of in NATO, but they also did things internally, restructured the government, the 1947 National Security Act, the creation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, many other things done to restructure the government to face sort of this new world challenge, the new world order or disorder that might be out there. They were remarkable in our history, and remarkable because they were out of character to what we had been for two centuries, and basically what we believed in. And yet they got us through that Cold War. They allowed for the kind of strategic thinking, the engagement, the involvement, the remarkable changes of conditions in other parts of the world. We can look at former enemies like Germany and Japan and see what happened. And I would contend that in 1989, when the wall came down, when the Soviet Union virtually collapsed, the third reordering took place. I was a new brigadier general, just selected at that time. Now, I had been in the military for 30 years at that point. And I had been told upon my selection that I would be assigned to the European Command in Stuttgart, Germany, one of our four regional commands, to be the deputy director of operations. Preparatory to that, we all went through a course that all new one-star generals and admirals go through here in Washington, short course, tied on to a trip to the region that you were going to be assigned to get briefings and familiarization and orientation discussions about the environment you were going to face. Now, as I went over to Europe, the wall was literally coming down at that time. I remember that we arrived in Berlin, and at that time we had a U.S. Army unit called the Berlin Brigade stationed there, and we were about to go through our briefings. And I had to believe those briefings probably hadn't changed for 30, 40 years, all about the threat, the Cold War, the Soviets, et cetera, et cetera, how we were positioned to deal with the onslaught through the Fulda Gap and anything that might come. Except that it was over, all of a sudden. So we arrived with briefers trying to figure out what to do with this gaggle of six or seven brigadier generals and rear admirals that they didn't have anything to say to, because they didn't know what was happening. So they did what any military would do when you're faced with that situation with a bunch of generals and admirals on the loose and nothing to tell them. They turned us over to a second lieutenant to sort of escort us around. And this young Army second lieutenant, probably trying to figure out what did I do to deserve this morning, was saddled with the six of us and told, I'm sure, to amuse us in some way while they figured out either what to tell us or get us on our way, because all their briefings were irrelevant now. And virtually, as I said, everything had just happened. So the young second lieutenant says to us, how would you guys like to go to East Berlin? And we looked at him and said, you know, we're all in uniform. Can we do that? And he said, I don't know. But he said, let's try it. And of course, God bless second lieutenants. We piled in his Volkswagen van, which looked like some hippie bus out of the 60s, and we drove through Checkpoint Charlie. And I got to tell you, it was like a shock. Checkpoint Charlie, I mean, I had never seen it before, but in my whole life, 30 years in the military, and before that, as I grew up in this Cold War environment, this was the forward outpost. Driving through that gap in the wall, we were going through the front lines. As we would say in the military, the forward edge of the battlefield. And nobody was there. Checkpoint Charlie was empty. And we just drove through. It had been abandoned. We arrived on the other side, and the main street, the main drag of East Berlin, was a facade, a Potemkin village. It looked modern from the outside, but as soon as you turned off a street, you saw still the bullet hole marks from World War II, the pockmarked buildings. You saw people driving around in 50s vintage bicycles, these old cars that were made in East Germany, the Trabis, belching smoke and barely operating. Now, I just came from West Berlin with Audis, BMWs, and Mercedes into this environment. This was the enemy. And it was like being transformed back in time, decades before. As we were driving around, the lieutenant found a Russian military garrison. He said, let's drive in there. So we drove through the main gate, and these Russian soldiers didn't know whether to shoot or salute as we came through. And we drove around their garrison, their caserne, went through their officers' club, went into their commissaries, and they looked like zombies. I mean, they were unsure what was happening, who were we, what the future was. As we came out from all this, after we toured around the city and various other places, and we came back through the wall, the lieutenant stopped his Volkswagen bus, and under the seat, he had a sledgehammer. And I got to tell you, I think he's the first one to do this. He said, let's break down the wall. So, of course, here's six brigadier generals and admirals banging on the wall. To no effect except small chips, which we collected up, and I'm sure we looked like idiots out there, but this was our symbolic victory celebration. As we came back out of there, and as we proceeded on to our next briefings in Heidelberg, I, for some reason, had the memory of being back in first grade, Black Horse Elementary School, Mrs. Harris's class, 1949. And I remembered that we had to take a pillowcase to school. And the reason we took a pillowcase to school is when the air raid sirens went off, we had to put it over our heads and go under the desks or go down into the civil defense shelter in the basement of the school that had that civil defense logo on it and actually had rations and other things stored there. And I can remember that growing up when the biggest debate was whether you let somebody in your bomb shelter or not, a neighbor that hadn't prepared. And so for 50 years of my life, I'd grown up in an environment that I became to know, an environment where there were two sides, a bipolar world, where each side was capable of destroying the planet, that the unthinkable was something we wanted to avoid, where we thought through how to contain and deter, where nobody could come to a conclusion that any major conflict between the two sides would benefit anyone on this planet. And it just ended. It had stopped. Now, as I took on my assignment in the European Command in Stuttgart, Germany, I remember President Bush, 41, talking about the New World Order, famous speech he gave. And it really talked about the self-ordering of the world. And it talked about a peace dividend, that now all the money, all the resources that were being consumed by the need to defend ourselves, that this could be put to some good. And it was a hopeful time. The doomsday clock had moved back, you know, many, many minutes. And all of a sudden, while I was there, we began to see things crop up and come out of the rocks. The Balkans came apart. Tito died and Yugoslavia disintegrated. In Africa, which was part of our area of responsibility, we were running all sorts of non-combatant evacuation operations. Saddam had gone into Kuwait. We had to move forces from the European Command to Turkey to run operations, and I participated in those in northern Iraq to protect the Kurds and attacks that we generated from the north to support General Schwarzkopf in the south. Contrary to this idea of a new world order, what we were seeing was a new world disorder. And we were watching the military come down very rapidly. I mean, it was almost a time that only since the end of Vietnam we had repeated, and that we watched this reduction in force, officers and NCOs that had wanted to make the military career now being X'd out and moved out, very, very high quality people that we were losing, the structure of the military coming down without any real plan or understanding whether we should or we shouldn't. Our leader at that time, one of the most brilliant generals I've known, General Jack Galvin, the United States Army, who was our Supreme Allied Commander of Europe and the Commander of the European Command, was deeply concerned that we weren't thinking through the new security requirements, that we were maybe investing too much on this idea of self-ordering. There was questions about whether NATO should continue to exist and whether the military had a role at all and whether we should reduce it down to almost pre-World War II. Kinds of sizes and end strengths and structure. I came home from there several years later, convinced that there's much more disorder in this world than we thought there would be. And this disorder, left unchecked, was going to threaten us. When I came back, one of the first things I did is I went to see my old friend Bob, who was a car dealer, because I bought probably about the last five or six cars before that from Bob. He was a retired Marine, so I knew he wouldn't screw me. And I go to Bob's Chevy dealership, and up to that point, everything I bought was Ford, Chevy, was United States of America car. And Bob had a Honda dealership. And I thought Bob had become a communist somehow. And I said to Bob, how could you have a Honda dealership, Bob? What happened while I was gone in Europe? And he hands me a certificate that shows that the Honda was made in Merrifield, Ohio. And he said, go down to the street to the Chevy dealer and find out where that car was made. And I did. And you have to demand the certificate. It was assembled in Mexico. So now I got a little confused. You know, I just saw an ad for Toyota that they have 10 facilities, about to have more in the United States. They have 250,000 plus American employees. And I was beginning to see the beginnings of globalization. Sort of the morphing which began in the economic world of, you know, things that had been traditionally had a national identity now had a global identity. And it began with the economy. And we began to see this globalization shift over not only from economic areas, but into other areas. People now thinking in terms of world courts, international standards of justice to hold people up to, which caused obviously a lot of concern in our military and elsewhere. We saw different communities in the world beginning to come together and form communities now where they maybe never could have been formed before. We saw the experimentations with the European Union, common currency, and trying to decide how far you take this. The questions of identity beginning to change, more and more organizations having global impact. And we saw the rise of something very strange, what we've come to term the non-state actor. I mean, up to this point, everything we did in the world was really based on the interaction of sovereign nations, whether it was war, peace agreements, alliances, or whatever. Sovereignty, the concept of the sovereign nation, was preeminent. Now, all of a sudden, these non-state organizations began to come up. Some of them clearly out there to do good, these non-governmental organizations. I've seen them. I've served 3 tours in Somalia. I was in northern Iraq with the Kurds and involved in the humanitarian missions in the Balkans and elsewhere. And it was amazing how you would find 60, 70, 100, 120, 130 of these organizations on the ground. They delivered food. They provided water. They helped restructure the society. They built institutions. And they had no national identity. We saw the rise of other non-state actors, not so good. We saw the rise of drug cartels, organized drug or criminal organizations with more power and more resources than some nation states. You can see it in Colombia and elsewhere, the mafias of the world, the drug cartels that began to become entities you had to deal with on a national level because of the power that they wielded. We also saw terrorist groups rise up, you know, extremist organizations. It was strange dealing with them because they had no capital. They had no geography. And it wasn't the same kind of interaction, good, bad, or indifferent, either in an alliance or in some sort of aggressive state that we had had before. And dealing with them became very different, very strange. It marked another piece to this changing world. Also, when the Soviet Union left, and there wasn't this competition for every inch of the earth that you're either on one side or the other, and the willingness to pay off any small nation state, dictator, whatever, to be on our side, suddenly we left adrift, places on the margins of the world that began to sink. And what happens when they begin to sink? Well, there were no restrictions now. So they packed up and they moved. And they migrated, legally or illegally. And vast communities began to transplant themselves, not only here from south to north, but in Europe, as we've seen, and elsewhere. Now the challenges and questions about mixed societies, identity, assimilation, all became major issues. It wasn't clear how that would be handled. God bless our country because of the ability to assimilate. I am the son of immigrants, and I know why they came here, my parents and grandparents. I know the opportunities that this nation has given us. But assimilation has even become more difficult here now, with the waves being almost unable to be absorbed and assimilated. And in places where assimilation wasn't really a characteristic of the state, as in Europe and elsewhere, became points of friction. You know, in addition to that, we began to see the rise of technology. I carry a cell phone here. I never use it. I never turn it on, because I didn't grow up in a techie age. And my wife complains, and my office complains that it's never on. I carry it because I feel obliged to. I mean, I flew into Dulles Airport yesterday. I flew from Texas, and I'm watching everybody at the gate with their laptops banging away, with their iPods and their Blackberries. They get on the plane. There's the technical instructions of what you can have on, not have on, and they put on whatever they can have on as soon as you land. And the flight attendant says you're now able to use your cell phones. Everybody's on a cell phone. And I say, who the hell are they talking to? I mean, more people knew that plane landed than knew Pearl Harbor was attacked the next day, I'm convinced. And a small confession to all of you, I take out my phone and pretend I'm calling somebody. Because, my kids already think I'm out of it, but I don't want anybody else to think that. You know, we're fighting a guy who's living in a cave with throwaway cell phones and the internet, and that's the way he keeps his organization together, and he's able to challenge us. As I was driving here from Williamsburg, my home today, I was listening to an expert talk about what it would require to build some sort of bomb and deliver it, say, to the center of one of our cities in a van, and how easy that could be if you get the fissile materials and the things necessary to do it. Of course, the concern now with North Korea and what it might do with the capability it's developing, or Iran, and then obviously fresh in our minds, the tragic plane crash we just saw in New York City. So you're looking at now this sudden rise and access to technology and this information age, where information flows back and forth, some of it accurate, some of it not. We grew up in an era where we knew if Walter Cronkite said it, it was right. Now you turn everybody on, you listen to everything from the left media to the right media to the middle media to no media to the bloggers and everybody else. What is right? What is wrong? What is accurate? We don't know. All these things combined, and many more that I haven't talked about, in what I call the perfect storm. And so in the last 16 to 17 years, this mix of phenomena have created a new world out there. This is not the world that most of us grew up in. It's not the world that I knew. I mean, thank God the Cold War ended. We could have destroyed our planet and our species easily. We didn't, and we got through it. But we opened up a different kind of world. A friend of mine described it to me in a way that I used in the book. He said it was like we slept with a cobra for half a century. And the cobra never bit us, thank God, because we were able to keep it away from us. We woke up one day and it was dead, and we were really happy, but the room filled with bees. And we now live in a room full of bees. And they bite and they sting. And one bite, one sting hurts, but can it kill you? But how about 50, 60, 160 stings? What can they do? And we now live in the world of these stings, generated by the changes caused by the phenomena that I described, all coming together. It's a different world out there. And we're not equipped to deal with it. Why? Because we trapped ourselves into believing that we came out a winner in 1989. We were exhausted. The other side was exhausted. We assumed, and I could understand why, that the world would have been tired of everything that went before it in that century. A new century was dawning, a new way to look at the world, and we would have this sort of common outlook. Didn't turn out that way. We don't have the kind of strategic thinking that maybe we had at the beginning of the Cold War, the Trumans, the Marshalls, the Kennans, that saw the threat, that provided the strategy and the underpinnings for us to get through 50 years without going to the massive kind of almost Armageddon conflict that could have resulted. We haven't strategically assessed and provided the guidance and direction and vision that we need in this new world. We are also saddled with old structures. Our government is something archaic in its structure. It is bloated bureaucracy. It is stovepipe bloated bureaucracy. I mean, with the 9/11 Commission, the Congressional Commission that looked at Homeland Security, what did they say? The government's too big, too layered, doesn't talk to each other. And so what did they do to solve the problem? They created more. You know, the Department of Homeland Security, the National Intelligence Directorate, more bloated bureaucracy that doesn't talk to each other. What kind of systems do we have? Patronage. Over 3,000 and some jobs that can be given out by the president, not based on quality. You're doing a heck of a job, Brownie. You know, I mean, we don't necessarily go to competence. You give enough to the campaign and you can be the ambassador to the dry Tortugas, you know? And hope maybe that I'm seeking to be the ambassador to the Vatican. That's my dream in the future. So I want to do something where you get the title, but there's not a lot of heavy lifting. We have a system of earmarks and pork. We don't fight it because we want our guy to go get it for us. So you put a defense bill out. That maybe in that defense bill we have a restricted budget, a military that needs more, or a State Department, or a foreign assistance, or domestic issues. And tacked onto that becomes bridges to nowhere, you know, grants to study the otter or whatever it is. This whole system has got to change. You know, this world will not allow us to waste resources at this time. This world is much more complex. I have spent time in the military and in the business world and in academia. You can't function in those fields unless your organization has become streamlined, flattened, and integrated. Those are the three ways you describe it. You have to make decisions very quickly to be competitive. Nothing's different about governments in this world. What's the challenge we face out there? The challenge we face out there is instability. That's the challenge, because unstable parts of the world now come back to haunt us. They tend to cut down rainforests. They tend to have agricultural and industrial products that are changing the climate. In case you haven't noticed, please believe me, if we actually go through a period of global warming that we're due for given the trends over the last 400,000 years, we're going to see a remarkably different world we're going to live in, and we haven't prepared for it. And people are exacerbating that situation around the world because they have no other choice. Because in order to survive, they're doing things that are damaging the environment. It's not only the environment. When they get upset and mad, they tend to blow things up. They tend to attack governments. They tend to create anarchy and chaos and come to our streets. When they can no longer survive in the hostile environment they're in, they tend to pick up and move and go where they can survive, whether it is legal to do it or not. They're coming because it is survival for them and for their families. If they cannot survive in that part of the, in those parts of the world, they're going to do things we don't like grow cocoa leaves and poppies that are going to end up on our streets, you know, as heroin or crack. And many, many other manifestations of the problem are going to be out there that we don't see. It used to be we were behind two mighty oceans, two innocuous borders. We didn't have to worry about that stuff. Manifest destiny. Worry about what's between the oceans. Our own internal destiny, Monroe Doctrine, maybe a little bit of concern about the hemisphere, but nothing beyond that. Those days are gone. You can't build the walls anymore. You can't isolate yourself economically, politically, in a security sense, or socially anymore. So out there where this instability is being generated and manifesting itself in this whole myriad of problems that we're facing, something has to be done, much like Truman saw, to help change the conditions. You know, instability, I have a simple definition for it. It's when a society finds itself in a hostile environment, either natural, man-made, or whatever, and it doesn't have the institutions, political, economic, social, security institutions, to cope with it. And what you need to do is help them structure the institutions to deal with it so they can cope with that hostile environment. That was really basically the formula for Iraq. You know, it needed to have the institutions to cope with a hostile environment. Now, for all sorts of reasons, not the purpose of this discussion, but we never effectively planned for and were able to help them build the institutions. And the natural fault lines and natural fractures took place. We don't understand this world. We have declared war on terrorism. The first time after retirement that I was asked to participate in a study with the joint staff, this colonel stands up and he's talking about the GWAT this, the GWAT that. And I know that as soon as you retire, they change all the acronyms in the military like they do the uniforms to confuse you. But I said, what is the GWAT? What is this? And he looked at me like I had two heads. He said, well, sir, of course, it's the global war on terrorism. And I said, well, let me get this straight. We have just declared war on a tactic. I mean, I could see Woodrow Wilson saying, I've now declared war on U-boat attacks, or FDR saying, I've now declared war on kamikaze attacks. We might say, Mr. President, you missed the boat. There's something deeper here. You're declaring war on a symptom, a tactic. And if you declare war on a tactic, you fight it tactically. You know, we certainly are doing the right things in going after the organization, the leadership, the funding, the cell structure. But what is it that Osama bin Laden needs? Needs an endless flow of angry young men. And what generates that anger? Some social, political, economic conditions, sense of injustice that drives them to look for a way to strike back. And here, conveniently, is this evil person that's advocating an aberrant form of Islam as a rationale and justification for those actions. And when you look at where these angry young men come from, and you look at the root causes, it was strange that the president described the root cause in Lebanon from the last dust-up when the Israelis went in, the root cause of the problem was Hezbollah. And I would offer Hezbollah as a symptom of the root cause. Hezbollah is a problem, certainly, but think of it in medical terms. You have to go to the true root cause, the disease itself, and not just treat the symptoms. We are treating symptoms and not root causes. And when I say we, I don't only mean the United States. This is a responsibility of the stable part of the world, the first world, many of whom have been absent. I mean, to our credit, we have engaged. I would argue in many cases, maybe not the right way, but at least we're up there trying. We've come to bat. And the leadership responsibility falls to us to get the world, the stable part of the world, to understand this and engage is critical. So I would tell you that my sense of the new threat to us is this wobbly, unstable part of the world that manifests itself in desperate attempts to get weapons of mass destruction, create the kinds of organizations, non-state organizations, that are generated from the chaos and the anarchy that threaten us in so many ways, be they criminal gangs, terrorist organizations, or whatever, that damage the environment, that can't support their populations, or either brutalize or decide to move and get up and then come and challenge our social systems and our system to be able to accommodate them. We are only seeing the beginnings of this unless the world comes together and is able to deal with it. And once again, like it or not, this is not out of altruism anymore. We are the leader of the world. We need to see this. I mentioned in my book that what I describe in there is a foxhole view. I'm not a strategist. I'm not a theorist. I'm somebody that has been around this world and still continue to go around this world almost every day in all nooks and crannies of the world, and I'm reporting back what I'm seeing and the changes. And the disconnect I see is that a bunch of 20, 30-some young, advanced degree, brilliant people in think tanks and in government designing one or two-page strategies, they're just not working out there. It just doesn't come into play on the ground. Those that don't understand cultures, that don't understand histories, belief systems, the environment they live in, the experiences they've gone through, their wants and needs and fears, can't just stand back here and say, well, the solution is fairy dust democracy on them. And democracy really is just an election. Enough elections around the world and we'll solve everybody's problems. We've seen what elections have gotten us in Iraq. We've seen what elections have gotten us in the Palestinian territories. It's not enough, and it's too simplistic. And I would offer you this last thought. No spin, no bumper stickers, no sound bites. What we require is the kind of Kennan Marshall level of thinking. When George Marshall proposed his plan, there was only 19% popular support for that plan. He gave 84 speeches around this country to explain why, the need. To the credit of the Americans at the time, they accepted it. They listened. And they, in the end, supported it. And we stabilized parts of this world that had known nothing but centuries of war and disorder. And you can look at a Japan today, or a Germany, or Western Europe, and you can see the changes. And you could see the hunger from Eastern Europe and elsewhere to be part of that system once it was created. And I would just say that kind of thinking and approach, that kind of rethinking our organization, our strategy, our commitment, that kind of thinking to re-examine what we face out there because it's so remarkably different is absolutely needed at this moment. So thank you for your attention, and I will be glad to take any questions you might have.
General Zinni, as I attempt to coax a question out of someone in the audience to start the dialogue, let me read, if I may, a quote from your book, Battle Ready. You said, "In the lead up to the Iraq War and in its later conduct, I saw, as a minimum, true dereliction, negligence, and irresponsibility, and at worst, lying, incompetence, and corruption. The president is owed the finest strategic thinking. He's owed the finest operational planning. He is owed the finest tactical execution on the ground. He got the latter. He did not get the first two." What sort of institutional changes do we need to make in order to make certain that the president gets the finest on all three levels?
Well, I think that we need to start with educating all Americans about understanding what we are trying to do and what we're able to do. And let me sort of peel this back because there are many parts to that question. The first thing I would tell you is that you were misled on what military planning is all about, unless you served in the military. And I would even say, unless you've served at some level where you understood the planning or were involved in the planning. I listened to the retired generals on TV talking about the planning up to the Iraqi war, and it became clear to me that the vast majority of them, with few exceptions, don't have a clue what they're talking about. You know, that they don't understand what a plan is. The plan is not something on a shelf. It is not simply paper. If you remember, the Secretary of Defense said that the plan he received was old and stale. The system is designed not to make a plan old and stale. When you create a plan, for example, the Iraqi war plan, which goes back since the time of Desert Storm and right after General Schwarzkopf's victory in that campaign, we started building the plan. The plan is reviewed every other year by the Joint Staff. The plan is exercised by the command, the U.S. Central Command, every other year. It is exercised every other year by the components, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, the ground, air, naval components. The plan, every time something changes in the allocation of forces, in a new capability, the plan is updated and changed. General Rick Shinseki, Chief of Staff of the Army, came to see me and says, I am involved in a program of transformation in the United States Army. This is the way it's going to evolve over years. He sat down with me and showed me my plan, his commitment to his forces to it, and how he will meet those commitments in the course of the transformation and the transition his service was going through. The United States Air Force comes down and creates a new set of ordnance with much more capacity. They talked to me in terms of my plan as to where that ordnance should be stored forward, how it will be deployed forward. You constantly measure the number of forces you have in the region to be able to hold. You have a system of deploying the forces in the region, time phased, where it's going to go. You work with allies in the region and where you receive these troops, where you stage them, their security as you move them forward and integrate them into the front lines. It is a dynamic process. It is more than numbers. And then when you go beyond that, you look at what the requirement is, not just to defeat the Republican Guard and to take down the capital of Baghdad. We looked at the aftermath, the need to secure the borders. We looked at the need to preserve a society that had natural fault lines and fragmentation points. As a matter of fact, when we brought all the agencies of government together to look at what we would face in the aftermath of an incursion into Iraq, we found that what we were being told by the intelligence community, by those in the region that know the country, by friends and allies who have missions in there, by our own assessments of State Department and others, that your biggest concern would be the fragmentation of the society. It will come apart like a cheap suitcase unless you do the things to hold it together. You're going to need numbers of troops in the hundreds of thousands, like 400,000. You're going to have to secure the borders. You're going to have to freeze the situation. You can't leave elements uncovered. You're going to have to maintain the military structure in there while you vet the leadership and use it and not your own troops. You're going to have to look at reconciliation as opposed to a de-bathification program that removes everybody at the lowest levels who know how to make the trains run on time and have no blood on their hands. And so for 6 years, this was the thinking, all tossed away. All tossed away with arrogance that those assumptions are way out of line, that the General Shinsekis of the world don't know what they're talking about. The General Zinnis of the world, the General Schwarzkopf of the world, and the two intervening commanders of CENTCOM between us, who have voiced the same thing I'm voicing here, all their cautions were thrown away. That we will be greeted as liberators, flowers in the street, you know, that we can beam in the Gucci guerrillas from London, the exiles, and they will be accepted by the people. Now, I would just tell you, you know, I wrote that because I didn't see that. And I will tell you, I did work on the intelligence on Iraq right up to the day of the war, even after I retired, and I did not see the threat. I did not see mushroom clouds. I did not see some sort of imminent or grave and gathering threat. Just the opposite in the intelligence I was looking at. You know, so something went wrong. And I would just say that institutionally, we can't let that continue to happen to us. We have lost our credibility in the region, gotten distracted from the real sources of threat to us, gotten distracted from what we need to do to help stabilize and prevent those kinds of threats from growing. You know, we're off consumed and immersed into Iraq, and Afghanistan is falling apart. Al-Qaeda hasn't had a stake put through its heart. The source of much of that anger, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has been left untended. The need for reform in the region, our voice is getting lost because our image is damaged. And so many of the things that are the root causes of diseases go unattended as a result. So I wrote that because what I saw, honestly, to me, was moving off something we had spent decades and years to work and understood. You know, we ended up with that disconnect again from those in the foxhole to those that make policy and strategy back here. And I would just say, I don't think it's necessary that everybody have served forward, whether it's a diplomat or a relief worker or someone in uniform. But I do think you need to mix those people and listen to them into the decision makers back here. We have a dearth of people with real experience, one way or another, that have actually have had to put time in those foxholes. And those foxholes are not just military again. You know, this was the same concern voiced by diplomats, by journalists that are forward, by aid workers that are out there in those non-governmental organizations, you know, doing the work of God out there. I think it's time that we bring them into the mix, too, because they understand the environment, they understand what they live in out there, and they can be the sanity test on ideas and schemes that let you believe you can beam in an exile, that a society is going to somehow magically hold together when everything in its history and its current situation tells you it's pulling apart. And so those were the flaws. We don't learn those flaws. We continuously repeat those same mistakes. And it's not just a matter of changing political horses. This is not a political statement. I mean, this was my party who disappointed me, I hate to say. You know, so it has to be something we learn. I want to go back to the point about restructuring government, about taking the time to write the strategy and to articulate it, you know, much like we did, again, that the Kennans and the Marshalls did, to take the time to think through how we apply our resources in the most effective and efficient way that protects our interests and promotes them in the best way, how we build alliances instead of criticizing people that don't fall in and march step, even if our march is a march of folly, old Europe. You know, insulting ways to treat allies that may need encouragement, sometimes pressure, but done in a way that, you know, mature nations and nations that have worked together have done it in the past. And I think that's what's been absent. And I think that's what we have to demand from our government.
General, I think your remarks describing the conditions of our world ought to be printed and buried somewhere so that archaeologists 500 years from now will understand what we went through. My question is a simple one. Do you see any Kennans and Marshalls on the political horizon?
Yeah, I do see people that think like that and people I learn from. The trouble is I don't see a way they succeed. You know, not that this is the intent of this discussion, but our political system doesn't allow them to come into positions where they can provide this. That they people that understand the world, people that have stature and character and have a view of the world that I think in this day and age is critically important when you go in. I worked for somebody like that, Colin Powell, my last boss in government, who was, you know, shunted aside, that probably had the clearest view of the world. And there are many others. But, you know, to ask people today to get themselves involved in the political process, this bitter, vitriolic, acid political climate that we have created, we just saw our governor, our former governor, back out of this because he wanted a real life, you know, and did not want to subject himself to that or his family to that. So if you want somebody that can offer in a civil way points of view, strategies. It should be debated. You don't have to accept my view of the world. There are others with other views that have been just as well thought out. Where is that debate? Where is that civil discussion? It's not happening on cable news or on the blogs. It's personal attacks. If you don't like the message, kill the messenger. And believe me, I know that from personal experience. I mean, that is the approach. So if you want those thinkers, and they're out there, that have that blend of intellect and experience, you know, that have thought through these things in a way that and have come to conclusions, then the only way you can empower them or encourage them at least to come forward with this is we have to have a system that not only encourages it but rewards it, but more importantly, doesn't punish it. If you offer a view that isn't popular or has a political opposition to it, the move is right toward the attack. Secondly, I would say, as I just said a little bit ago, We are in the era. We move so fast that we want the bumper sticker. We want the soundbite answer to everything. The most complex problems in the world, we answer in three-word phrases. You know, and how could that be? I oftentimes get asked, you know, can you come on our news show and, you know, we got 2 minutes. We want to talk about the Arab-Israeli peace process. Well, I can't say Arab-Israeli peace process in 2 minutes, you know? And that's about how much time we're going to give to it, how much attention. I was thinking the other day as I was on my computer. When we first got computers, we went on the internet. I was dazzled with the speed at which I could access the internet through a modem. Now, I get anxious and ticked off, and, you know, you need DSL, you need something even faster. You know, somebody comes in and looks at somebody that's still on a modem. I'm one of those. And they say, are you kidding me? I mean, you're in the dark ages. You know, the speed of expectations now is so great. And we want something that soothes our beliefs. In this room, all of us come from some sort of basic foundation, a set of values, what I like to call a code. We each have a code. And I would venture to say in this audience, the codes are pretty mixed. The codes could come from a more liberal or a more conservative point of view, socially or politically or otherwise. And all of our codes are imprinted on us in a way. We like our codes to be fed. I want to hear what I believe. I want it reinforced. I want to go to the TV news station that slants the news the way I want to hear it. I don't want to listen to the other guy's news station to get another point of view. So we come to the place where we accept this political process, which is encouraging good people not to participate, that we want the shorthand answer, and that we want to be fed and reinforced in what we believe and not challenged. So as long as we accept all three of those, you're going to get what you've got.
General, with the recent decision by former Governor Warner not to seek the presidency, seems like there's a vacancy. Would you be willing to throw your hat into the ring?
Not at all. Not at all. My parents were married, and I don't think I want to get involved in a process like that. I just, first of all, it's not a process that interests me at all. I like serving my country in a way where I go where there's something that needs to be done at the behest of one of our leaders. I enjoy that the most. I mean, beside the military years, I've been involved in 8 peace mediation processes around the world, from Indonesia to the Philippines to Israeli-Palestinian, as was mentioned, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia. And I enjoy that kind of work at the other end. I guess it's simplistic to say it, but I like to see the results right there. The thought of being in Washington and being part of the bureaucracy or subjecting yourself to this political process doesn't interest me at all. I have 2 proud achievements in my life. I never served at the Pentagon, and I never learned to play golf.
General, how did the Joint Chiefs express themselves if their bosses don't want to listen?
Well, it takes courage. I mean, first of all, I would say for all of us that have been bosses, you have to encourage people to challenge you. It's not easy. As a matter of fact, the more senior you get, despite saying it, despite demonstrating you don't kill a person that opposes your point of view, you still are going to have a natural reluctance. There are a lot of people out there that want to figure out what you want to hear and play it back to you. There are a lot of people that tend to be sycophantic. There are a lot of people that are invested more in their own careers. There are a lot of people that have good motivations. They want to serve you. They want your way of doing it to come out and work. I mean, it's a positive thing they want to have happen. It is the rare person that's willing to stand up and challenge you. I often use as an example my intelligence officer at CENTCOM. As a good example, he was an Army 2-star general, and he was kind of an irreverent curmudgeon. And every time I'd ask him a question, he'd say, "Why are you asking me that question?" You know, and I'd say, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, why are you asking me?" He says, "Because if I answer it, I could give you the answer you want. You go off and do something stupid." He said, "You know, because I don't know the motivation or the rationale behind it. You got to give me the rationale so I put in context for you the answer." And I thought to myself, wouldn't that have been nice at the beginning of this incursion into Iraq, if somebody had come back and asked, done just that, to what that general said to me, you know, why are you asking me that question? If you're going to justify a war on this basis, then maybe I need to put it in context. I mean, there's one way you can answer a question, and there's another way you can get into the intent, the motivation of whoever's asking it, and give them the context, content, your expertise. So the other part of leadership is to ensure that freedom is there, to engage in that, to give it context, to allow for dissent, for allow for opposition. I want to give you two short examples that I lived through as a four-star general, commander of U.S. Central Command. Back in the mid-90s, the Iraqi Liberation Act was being passed by Congress, funding $97 million to the exiles, Ahmed Shalabi and the exiles in London. I thought it was a stupid idea. Now, the administration at the time, the Clinton administration, accepted it and agreed with it. I testified before Congress, Senate Foreign Relations, or Senate Armed Services Committee, and said it was a stupid idea, pretty much in those terms, and was raked over the coals by the committee. Afterwards, Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen called me in. He said, now you understand your position is different than the administration's position. You've taken an opposite position. I said, yes, sir. He said, okay, so just as long as you're clear on that. And we discussed it back and forth. He then said, get in the car, we're going over to the Hill. He took me in the evening to see Senator Lott, who was Senate Majority Leader, Senator Daschle, Minority Leader, and the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. As we walked into each of those, he said, this is General Zinni, Commander of U.S. Central Command. You have just passed the Iraqi Liberation Act. The administration accepts it, and it's part of their policy. He disagrees, and you need to hear him. It's not my view, but you need to hear the other view. The second example, same man, Secretary Cohen, when we were getting ready to strike Iraq because they were not complying with the inspectors at the time, we had two different plans to go with. I favored one plan. The Joint Chiefs of Staff favored another plan, which he also favored. He took me to Camp David to meet with President Clinton and said, this is the plan I favor. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Joint Chiefs favored also, but General Zinni, your commander in the field, U.S. CENTCOM, favors another plan. You need to hear them both, Mr. President, get both views and make your decision. Do you think that would go on right now? And I would say, that's what you need to encourage. I was told by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hugh Shelton, by the Secretary of Defense, Bill Cohen, who was my boss, Secretary Cohen was my boss, that if I had something to say and I objected to any policy, their door was always open and they would ensure that my view was heard up to the highest level of command. Now, that's what has to happen to encourage people to give to the most senior people that have to make these life and death decisions, the welfare of our nation, to get those points of views. You know, and I could walk away whether my view was accepted or not to say I was heard. I mean, I might have to make a decision about whether I could stay or not, but I could never say that my view wasn't heard. And I think that's the kind of atmosphere we've got to create in government. This idea that, you know, the strength and confidence in your own character and abilities to say, I can go before my boss and tell him I have two or three subordinates with different views, and it's important enough for him to hear all of those. I'll give him my opinion, but I want him to hear all of those. That's the kind of leadership we need to create. It's not only a matter of courage from the person that has to give it. It means that we have to educate and develop leaders that have the confidence to understand it makes them stronger. If they do that, it makes their organization stronger. It makes the trust from their subordinates stronger. And we get away from that when we go to the old style of authoritarian leadership. And we don't surface to the people that have to make critical decisions all the aspects and views and opinions necessary to make a credible decision.
General, I have a question. It used to be, anytime an officer had the uniform on, it was an officer, it was implied that that officer had integrity and honor. But I find it now that the officer corps, that is both across all branches of the military, are now running each other down. We find our battlefield heroes that have been given battlefield awards for bravery are now being defiled. I believe this has a negative impact on the morale of the troops. Why should an individual go beyond a call of duty on the battlefield if he subsequently, or she, is going to be run down? Would you comment on that, please, sir?
Well, I think we have to first say that we should always honor and respect courage in the battlefield. In my mind, having seen a lot of battlefields around the world and seen a lot of heroic action, that's something you honor and respect. Now, I would caution you on one thing. Those that have done that for their nation, that have sacrificed, that have demonstrated that courage, when they're put in position to make decisions at a more senior level, there shouldn't be a pass or an automatic assumption that because of that courage, everything they do after that should go unchallenged. And I don't mean challenge to their personal integrity or challenge to them or to their personal character, but I mean challenge to their views. If you believe that just because someone has done remarkably well on the battlefield, that makes him or her the ideal Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or President of the United States, that may not be sufficient. You know, I do think we ought to subject our military leaders to challenge, you know, on decisions of strategic importance, of policy. We shouldn't get a free pass. The military is subordinate to civilian leadership. Now, the military, including me, being one of the most outspoken critics, demand decent civilian leadership. If the civilian leadership is not delivering what I feel the troops need on the battlefield and what's in the best interest of the nation, I am first and foremost a citizen and have the freedom and the right under the first article of our Constitution to say so. Now, some military people don't feel that way. And I feel if the senior leadership in the military are not holding up to their responsibilities, they should be subjected to that criticism. They shouldn't be personal attacks, again, as I said in my talk, and they shouldn't in any way demean what they have demonstrated on the battlefield. But I think that we as citizens should not take a back seat because of someone's heroism when that person is speaking in terms of strategy and policy and the welfare of the nation. They should still be, like any other citizen, any other person that's in government, they should be subject to our questions, should be subject to our challenges. You know, and so I think we can separate the two. I don't see that as demeaning in any way. As a four-star general that served two tours in Vietnam, three in Somalia, in Iraq, many battlefields in the world, wounded and everything else, every year, several times a year, I had to go before Congress, sit in that seat with those Klieg lights on, and be questioned pointedly, directly, sometimes heatedly, by those senators about what I was doing in my command. To me, there was nothing wrong with that. They weren't in any way demeaning or degrading me by challenging me. And some of them were, you know, pretty actively challenging me and pretty forcefully challenged me. But they represent you. You know, they're your representatives. And you should never, ever give the military a pass, just like you shouldn't give the diplomats a pass, just like you shouldn't give the economists a pass or anybody else in government, anybody else that serves you. Last point, I, like you, and everybody else who served in uniform swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States, not to the President of the United States, to the Constitution of the United States. We don't swear an oath to an individual. We don't swear an oath to a king or a sovereign. We swear an oath to a concept that defines our society. We swear an oath to a law, but it's more than a law. It is who we are. And so anything in that Constitution I have said to you, I will put my life on the line to defend. Your right to speak, your right to challenge is in that Constitution. Your right to participate in the rule of law is in that Constitution. I may not like what you say, but I will die defending it. I swore to that. And so I think that has to be the context we put it in. Yes, sir, you got to come up.
Upon being a political scene here now, where we have one officer who has gone beyond the call of duty on the battlefield,
yeah,
yet still he's eroded. I believe in that situation now, if I had to go through
that
again, I would do so differently because of the fact that as I get back home, my various peer groups may run me down and say, I don't deserve the honor and recognition which I got.
Well, let me, I misunderstood, and let me agree with you on that. I thought the attacks on Max Cleland, on John Curry, on John McCain, and again, you have Republicans and Democrats, these blogger attacks, people with political motivations to go back and try to rewrite history, to me, it's despicable. And it's part of that sort of acid process I talked about that we expect to subject people for. You know, I know of no one that ever served. I served 1 year short of 44 decades in the military, and some years after that on State Department missions. I know no one that has served that long that you can't go back and find fault with, that made mistakes, that made decisions that work out well. Now, if they were failures, or they were decisions of incompetence, or decisions of hubris or arrogance, or they were decisions that were not based on fact, then I think they should be held accountable. But to attack them for times when they were in the arena, when others only managed to make it to the grandstands, and throw rocks and critique, to me is unfair. You could take almost any award anybody has received and find those that will challenge the reward, because it's a subjective view. It's a subjective view as to whether you receive an award for heroism and to what level that award should go. You know, we've got to stop that kind of 30 years later examination and 30 years later critiquing and criticizing from those that haven't even been there or weren't on the scene when a service has accepted it and the award has been rendered. You know, to me, that's not what we're about. It's not how, and I understand your question now, it's how we do not honor that service. We look, in this state, we're going through this now. We are going through issues, whether they're significant or not, that are 30 years old, which ought to tell you that whoever runs for a public office had better go back to their college days or their high school days and reexamine themselves, because it's going to come out, not necessarily how it truly happened. And the battlefield is no different than that.
General Zinni mentioned something that's of great importance to the Miller Center, and that is this notion that so much of what passes for civil discourse today is in 2 or 3 minute sound bites on cable channels. We are very grateful at the Miller Center to our broadcast partners at WVPT, the board of directors of whom is with us today, for their willingness to provide primetime airtime to the Miller Center Forum so that people, thoughtful people, articulate people like General Zinni's views can be presented much more fully. I want to recognize them and thank them. And I'd like to ask Lee Middleditch, who is on the board of WVPT and chairman of the Miller Center Foundation, if he would escort General Zinni to the book signing. And please join me in thanking General Zinni.
Thank you.